All right. Well, good to see everybody out tonight. Good to see, we actually have a pretty good crowd for Wednesday night. So good to see everybody here. Good to have a couple of visitors with us as well. Glad to have you with us again. And glad to have the opportunity to continue our discussion, whichever way that discussion actually goes. So I sent out an email offering that if there are still questions regarding some of the stuff we've been talking about for about the past 2 weeks now, we had started discussing some of the realities of some of the biblical text of resurrection, some of the concepts of what is awaiting us in life to come, which, and we've talked about that there's a lot of that that is shrouded still in mystery. There's still a lot of that that is difficult to grasp and difficult to understand, and many of it that's not meant for us to understand on this side of death. But we've been talking about some of the things that the biblical text does talk about, some of the realities that has for us. And so if there are questions about that, I definitely want to continue to open the floor for that. If there's not, we can definitely continue in the Nature of God book. But either way, looking forward to a good class. Before we dive into that, Al, would you mind leading us in an opening prayer? All right. So with that in mind, as I mentioned in the email, are there any questions? Are there any things that that were brought up in either the past two sermons, past Bible class that we were talking about? Any questions or comments or anything that that we wanted to bring out? Like I said, definitely want to leave the floor open for any of that. Make sure that we're not leaving anybody in the dust on that. Okay, that makes that easy as well. All right, last call. All right, well then awesome. Then we'll go ahead and continue on in lesson number 7 on the nature of God. So we've been talking about the nature of God. We've talked a little bit about what's been revealed as far as the triune nature of God. We've talked a little bit about the importance of why we're studying this, about why this is important. And so last time we got to start talking a little bit about some of the characteristics of God that are discussed. And so the one that kind of led a little bit into a little bit of derailment was the idea of God as spirit. So we've explored that for a little bit. So now we're going to continue moving on to some of the other characteristics that are talked about. And I think particularly the one we're going to talk about tonight, and I'm hoping to talk about more than just this one, but if we only focus on this one, that is perfectly okay. But the idea of holiness is a very important notion in the biblical story. It's a very important notion about understanding who God is, but not just who God is, but also our relationship with God. The understanding this concept of holiness clarifies a lot of the biblical story, that if you don't have this understanding of holiness, the Old Testament especially is not going to make sense in a lot of capacity, but even the New Testament, there's going to be some questions that emerge about a proper understanding of God's holiness. So, very simply, right off the bat, what does holiness or holy mean? What is that word? Yeah, so and to kind of give a little bit of clarification, there's probably a couple of different ways we can describe this. Probably the most common one that captures a lot of it is the idea of set apart, the idea of a uniqueness about God. And so when we use that term set apart, what do we mean? Why is God set apart? Why do we say that? Yeah, so that's what, and we talked a little bit about this when we talked about the triune nature of God, that God is one, but God is three. That's that emphasis of God as one, that God is unique. Even amongst the fact that there are many spiritual beings, that there are many spiritual powers, there is no God but Yahweh. There is no Lord but the Lord. And so God is unique, even amongst the spiritual powers, but certainly from our perspective, as mortal humans, God is very distinct from us. He is very different from us in a multitude of ways. And so that idea of holiness, that kind of ties into that distinctness, that uniqueness of God. What else do we mean when we talk about the idea of God being set apart? Yeah, and so in a way, there's almost, I mean, this is not, I'm trying to think of a good way to phrase this. We are made in the image of God, but we are not God. There are parts of God, and there are aspects of God, excuse me. There are aspects of God's character that are sometimes alien to us, that are very difficult for us to comprehend, just by the notion that we're physical, just by the notion that we're mortal, just by the notion that we are not omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And so Isaiah kind of puts that into the framework of some of the things that God tells us, some of the things that God asks us to do, that they might be different than what we see as the right way to do it. And really what I think the biblical text consistently points out is that means we're wrong, is that means that we have a flawed perspective. Ecclesiastes talks a lot about this, that even sometimes when things appear unjust, even when things appear as if fairness is not the winning virtue, Ecclesiastes reassures us that that's because we have a limited perspective. We don't see things the same way that God does. And so there's a humility that naturally comes in with holiness, and we talk about this a lot, that we have to accept our limitations compared to that of God. And so that idea of God's ways not being our ways, that's an important part of this. What else about the idea of set apart or other aspects of holiness that we might know? Yeah, so Zane makes a good point that there's a connection here between holiness and kind of the opposite of holiness. I think vulgarity, commonality is a good idea. That things that are not unique, things that are not part of God itself. And so, yeah, there's a distinction here, and this kind of ties into another word that I think is important when talking about holiness, and that's the idea of purity. And so what might be a connection between those two words? I mean, what am I trying to get there with the connection between holiness and purity? Yeah, so I think Zane's kind of hitting the nail on the head here with this. There's a connection here between holiness and purity, and I like that surgical tool example that, you know, you work very hard to keep things that are meant to be for a specific purpose, particularly cleanly things, important things. You work hard to keep those unsullied. You work hard to not get those dirty with whatever it may be. In the case of surgical instruments, you don't want to get germs on there. But in the case of God's holiness, Zane points out, it's the idea of sin. And so sin, as we've talked about and kind of alluded to some in this class, sin is rebellion against God. Sin is going against the wisdom of God. It's going against the natural created order that God has set up. And so sin is anathema to God. And literally, that word anathema, it essentially means the idea that it can't be in the presence of God. There's a really helpful analogy when talking about holiness that I saw that compares, and I think it's even a little bit of a biblical comparison, that compares God to the sun. And so the sun, again, strictly kind of keep an Old Testament viewpoint, don't get too deep into astronomy, but the sun is unique amongst the stars. It's unique amongst our solar system. It's big, it's bright. There's nothing else that quite compares to it. Even if there's other lights, to use the Genesis terminology, nothing's quite like the sun. It's unique. But what happens if you get close to the sun? You can destroy it. I mean, just the reality, if you get too close to the sun, not that any of us have ever worked towards that, but if you ever get too close to the sun, you burn up. Anytime like an asteroid or anything flies near the sun, it gets burnt up. And so there's a danger almost in getting too close to the sun. There's almost a proper distance in a way that you have to keep in order not to be damaged. And it's not because the sun is bad. It's not because the heat is necessary for life. The light that it produces is necessary for life, but there's still a danger because it's so much grander than us. It's so much more intense in its heat than us. You'd be very careful about getting close to it. Well, there's a similar notion with God's holiness. Turn over, if you will, to Exodus chapter 3 for kind of an easy example of this. We can go to a bunch of different passages about this. But in Exodus chapter 3, in a very unique sense, God kind of gives this idea of kind of keeping space for God's holiness. And so in Exodus chapter 3, we've got Moses in exile from Egypt. He goes up to the mountain of God on Horeb. And in verse 2, it says, "The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, 'I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up.' When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush, and said, 'Moses, Moses,' he said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground.' And he said, 'I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God." And so you see there's kind of this tension in God's holiness where God wants us to come look at him. He wants us to approach him. But you got to keep your space. Not because God is bad, not because God is wicked, but because God is in fact so good, he is in fact so righteous, that our sin kind of causes a barrier. It prevents us. And even a man as righteous as Moses can't just waltz into the presence of God. We're going to see this even later in the Pentateuch, where when the tabernacle is built, and later on in the story when the temple is built, you don't just go waltzing into the presence of God. And it's because of God's holiness, and that God's holiness cannot endure, or sin cannot endure being in the presence of God's holiness. Sin is destroyed in the presence of God's holiness. Well, the problem for us is that we're marred by sin, that we're marred by our impurity, to use that terminology. And so that's a part of the reason that so much of the law is dedicated to establishing how can a holy God dwell in the midst of an unholy people. And so you have space given for the tabernacle, and most people could only go but so close. And even the priest could only go so far into the tabernacle, and even the high priest could only go into the most kind of hot spot presence of God's holiness once a year to make atonement. And even then, there was rituals to cleanse the tabernacle and to make sure that it was not corrupted by sin. And so, in fact, when we talk about God's holiness, there is, obviously, it speaks to the majestic, it speaks to the awe of God, but there's also a danger for us as sinful people, because we as sinful people cannot be in the presence of God. There's a veil, there's a barrier there. And so, very simply, there is, to maybe use an odd term, there is a problem with us and God's holiness. And it's not a problem with God, it's our problem, because we can't approach the source of life when we are marred by sin. And so, what is the biblical notion of how to fix that? Okay, and so to kind of break that down, yes, because that is ultimately the answer, is Jesus is going to be the bridge over that gap. But how? How does Jesus fix that barrier, fix that literal space, so that we can go and be in the presence of God, and that God can come to us? How is that barrier addressed through Jesus? Okay, so kind of both getting into that idea, the idea of a propitiation, the idea of a cleansing, very similar to how in the Old Testament, the tabernacle and the temple was cleansed with blood. There is very much a sense, and a much fuller sense, that Jesus' blood provides a purification for us. But even if that's the case, and again, that is the case, that just gets us to kind of neutral ground. That still doesn't necessarily mean that we can be in the presence of a holy one, of one who is so far beyond our presence. So how else does Jesus solve the barrier? That's certainly part of it, is that he removes the sin. He cleanses us of our iniquities that would hinder us from seeing God. But how else does Jesus work on our holiness? Yeah, so definitely. So part of that is that Jesus serves as the high priest, is the way that Hebrews is going to phrase it, that he is a mediator of the covenant between us and God. And so we read about that in multiple different places in the New Testament, that he intercedes on our behalf. How else is Jesus involved in that holiness idea? Right, yeah. And so that's one of the big things. We've talked about this in our adult class on Sundays with the book of Acts, is that the Spirit dwells within us. In the same way, Paul says in Romans that the Spirit intercedes for us. It groans for us in words too deep to understand. Turn over real quick, if you will, to kind of maybe point the direction of where I'm looking at. Go to Isaiah. Now, the caveat has to be given that this is a vision, and there's always that caveat that you have to kind of give with the vision, that it's a vision. It is a way of expressing a truth through kind of some fantastic images. But there's something being said here in Isaiah's his image that he has here. And so in Isaiah 6, Isaiah says, "In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, two he covered his feet, with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke." And so Isaiah is given this very grandiose image of the holiness of God, the glory of God in the temple. And the seraphim, these majestic beings, are crying out, "Holy, holy, holy." I mean, they're screaming out, really, that he is holy. And what is Isaiah's reaction in verse 5? He said, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." What is Isaiah's reaction to seeing the holiness of the Lord? He's like, I don't belong here. I'm not supposed to be in the temple. I'm definitely not supposed to be in the presence of God. I'm about to die. Like, I know what happens. And we see this talk multiple times that, you know, no man can see the Father, but no man can see God unless he dies. And so Isaiah's like, well, I know what's going to happen. Like, I'm not worthy of being here. I'm going to be burned up. And yet, in verse 6, one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth with it. Which, again, like, up until this point, you're like, oh, okay, Isaiah's definitely about to die because burning coals don't go well with lips. And said, behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven. So this clearly links in with what we've been talking about, that part of this concept is that sin is forgiven, iniquity is taken away from us. But what's going on with this image? What is trying to be conveyed here? Yeah, so again, we use that terminology. You have to be purified, you have to be cleansed in order to be in the presence of God. Where does the coal come from? You know, it's something holy. So you're in the temple. The only coals that are going to be there are from the altar, or from the things that would be sacrificed. And so the very radical claim that Isaiah is making here, and the New Testament then follows it up, is not just that we have been cleansed, not just that God has reset us to level zero, but that God's holiness has been imparted into us. Which is a really radical notion, especially in the Old Testament, because that's not how holiness works. In fact, Habakkuk talks about this in the third chapter of his prophetic book. He goes and tells the priest, he's like, hey, you understand that you can't touch something holy to something unholy and make it holy. That it goes the other way. Something holy can be corrupted, but something unholy doesn't become holy just because a holy thing touches it. And so there was a very clear conception that you couldn't just be made holy. You'd be cleansed, you'd be washed, but you couldn't fix unholiness like that. And yet what God is saying is, in fact, that is exactly what I'm going to do. And in fact, you see, that's what Jesus does. Because Jesus goes around throughout the Gospels and he's touching all these unclean things, all these unclean people. And he's not made unclean by it. In fact, his cleanliness, his holiness is imparted on to those people. They are healed. They are brought into that presence of God. They're not destroyed by the presence of God. They're purified by it. They're made holy by the presence of God. And so what I want us to see here with this conception of holiness is not just that we are made clean enough that we can be in the presence of God's holiness, but that through the Spirit, through sanctification, we are being made holy. In fact, that's the big claim of the Levitical law. In Leviticus 11:44, it says, be holy, for I am holy. This is one of the great wonders, really, of God's relationship with us. It's not just that he's fixing what's flawed in us, but that he is building us up into the image of God. He is building us up into something holy and righteous. Now, we don't want to go too far into that concept, because that concept is not claiming we're going to become a God. It's not claiming that we're going to become part of God. But what it does show is that God's holiness is being gifted to us. He is molding us. As Trish talked about, the Spirit of God is within us. The blood of Christ cleanses us. The love of Christ animates us. So that when we are in the presence of God, we have not just been brought back to level zero, but that we have been sanctified and made holy to be in the presence. Does that make sense? Thoughts and comments on that? Questions on that notion? Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's part of what, again, the Levitical law was about. And I think sometimes there's this misconception of the Mosaic law that it was all about sacrifices and making things pure and everything. And that was a big part of it. But the reason for that was so that Israel could be this nation of priests, so that they could be God's kingdom on earth, that they would be able to come and spread the presence of God amongst the nations. Again, they fail at that miserably. And ultimately it is the man Jesus that comes to do what Israel was incapable of doing. But that has been one of the grand storylines of all of creation, has been God's holiness breaking through into this earth, breaking through the corruption of sin, and beginning to not just fix it, but to beautify the creation, to work through bringing the kingdom about. And so this conception of holiness is more than just an abstract fact about God. It is the work that God is preparing within us, that as God is holy, we are being made holy. And so that has a lot of, I think, a lot of application for us. And part of it, as Zane just said, is one of them, is that we are being prepared for good works. We are being prepared to go do holy things. We're being prepared to do the things of God. Again, not just being brought back to level zero, but being built up to be good, to be a force of good in the world, to be a force of spreading the gospel, of spreading the kingdom. What are some other applications of that? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and that's one of the things that, you know, when Trish is talking about that notion, Job talks about this in, towards the end of Job, when God is talking with Job. One of the challenges that God gives to Job, he's like, okay, let's run the world for a day according to your very strict conception of justice, that wickedness is met with destruction and righteousness is rewarded. And very quickly, the realization is like, you know how quickly the world would be over with? I mean, do you realize how quickly all of us would be destroyed if that was how God's justice worked? Is that immediately wrongdoing was dealt with right there. That's part of the reason that Peter talked about the long-sufferingness of God. The point is not that God is holding himself back. He's like, oh, I don't want to be around those filthy people. It's that because he is merciful, because he is long-suffering towards us, he's like, I'm building you up so that we can be together, so that I can dwell with you. That was why, you know, we sometimes skip over the passages in Exodus that talk so long about the building of the tabernacle. The reason God cares so much about the tabernacles, he's like, I want to be with my people. I want to dwell in the midst of Israel. And so we're going to take very careful precautions so that what happened to Nadab and Abihu doesn't just happen to everybody. The people don't just waltz in and be destroyed by God's holiness, because God is aware of what will happen if we are improperly prepared to be before the Lord. And so again, that's one of the great storylines of creation, is God preparing us to be in his presence. That he is eagerly anticipating the day where we will be able to be with him unveiled. And so that's part of the great work of Jesus and the work of the Spirit within us today, is preparing us for that, preparing us to be in the presence of holiness and working on that in us now. So yeah, excellent point. Other thoughts or comments on that notion of holiness? Yeah, and again, like Zane is talking about, that's what, you know, the conclusion of that whole storyline is that God's holiness breaks through, and that God's holiness does begin to work through that. That as God's people are redeemed, as creation is redeemed, that holiness comes in, and that it does drive out the forces of darkness. It drives out the spiritual rebellion. It drives out the sin. And so the conception in Revelation in 21 and 22 is that there's not even a need for a temple anymore. It actually says that there's no temple because God is in the midst of the city, that God is there. There's no more need for the space. There's no more need for the tabernacle or the temple or the separation or the veil. God is there because his people have been raised to be like Jesus. They have been transfigured like Jesus. And so when you get this image of, the temple city and the garden city, really, is that the whole thing has been redeemed. The whole thing has been made pure. And there is no more sin. There is no more rebellion against God because we've made our choice. We have allied with him. We have sided with him. We have placed our trust in him. And so we have been transformed by that holiness to be people that can be in his presence. So yeah, that ultimately is the picture of, you know, life after death, is that death has been conquered. Sin has been conquered. It has been done away with, and that there is only God's holiness and our great task before him. So yeah, absolutely. Other thoughts or comments on the concept of holiness? Or how it applies to us? You know, what does this change in us to view the idea of holiness in this capacity? What does this push us to do? Yeah, sometimes, you know, there's been sometimes really poor conceptions of the reward that we are going towards, of what we are pushing for. And sometimes, you know, the afterlife is almost described as this, like, we're just like sleeping. It's like we're just like taking a nap. Or, you know, we're at Disneyland, and we're at Disneyland forever and ever. That's not the point. The point really is not the place. The point really is not the area. The point is that we are in the presence of God. The point is that we are seeing God face to face. And that really is supposed to be the driving factor. We talked on Sunday about, you know, the hope that Paul had, that after he died, he would see Jesus. That he's like, listen, at the end of the day, like, there's lots of work for me to do here, but if I die, it's better for me. Like, I get to go see Jesus. I get to go be with him. And particularly think about how powerful that must have been for Paul. And I know it is for everybody, but Paul got like just that little glimpse of Jesus on the road to Damascus, and it literally blinded him. I mean, it just, and think about how for the rest of his life, he's like, all I want to do is see that again. All I want to do is to be in his presence, this man who has saved me. And so I think that is ultimately what it should be, a motivation for us. It should be a call to faith for us, is that we know what we're going to. We don't know the specifics of it. We don't know all the details of it. We don't know exactly what everything's going to look like, but we know one thing for sure, is that God is going to be there. That Jesus is awaiting us there, and that he is calling us to him. And that alone, if nothing else was true, that alone is what motivates us to faith, knowing that the good God that loves us is waiting for us and is preparing us to be in his presence forever. That alone is the faith that drives us. And so, yeah, that absolutely should be a huge part of our motivation, is that we, in some ways, we don't know what's happening, but we know the most important thing of what's going to happen. Other thoughts or comments on this notion of holiness? All right, so the next chapter, so we got kind of the holiness and spirit in chapter 7. And then in chapter 8, we start to get into kind of briefer descriptions. And so really the next couple of chapters, you've got about like 10 different brief attributes that are talked about. And so I don't want to spend but so much time on these, because I think some of these are kind of compressed in some ways. And I understand why, because, you know, you're trying to fit in an entire extended discussion on the nature of God in a 13-week class. That's really tough, because you really just need to go through the whole Bible in order to even begin to understand that and then realize how much you have left. But the first one that he talks about in chapter 8, I think, is a crucial one, because really it ties in with the notion of God as holiness. Because if the only thing about God is that he's holy, is that he's set apart, is that he is greater than us, then that's not really a God that you would worship. It's a God you'd fear. It's a God you'd be terrified of. It'd be like if the sun was, you know, 100 feet away from you. Like, you'd respect it, and you'd want to make sure you didn't offend it. But more than anything, you just want to be avoided by it. You just don't want to get near that thing. If that's all God is just raw power and just greater than everything else, there's really nothing to admire there. It's just a force of nature. And so what transforms that understanding is understanding the character of God as love. That he is not just raw power. He is not just this wholly unique thing that we cannot approach. But that, in fact, that raw power and wholly unique thing is love. And loves us. And is by the very essence of his being, love. And that is truly, I think, the most remarkable thing about God, is that he is so far beyond our conception. He is so far outside of our understanding. And yet, the defining feature that the Bible most consistently highlights is that he is love. And I think this sometimes gets missed, and sometimes I think we almost skip past God's love to make other points. And we almost want to say, it was like, yeah, God is love, but, and then we go to all the other things. Yeah, God is love, but, you know, make sure you don't do X, Y, and Z. And I think it's important sometimes to just dwell in that notion that God is love. Because the Bible writers don't really say it as God is love, but X, Y, Z. They feel very content making the claim solidly that God is love. So what does that mean? I think sometimes it can get kind of distilled down to this very wishy-washy notion. But there's something very powerful here. What does it mean that God is love? Not just that God loves, but God is love. Yeah, and I think Trish puts it a great way, that you can't separate the two. And so not only, I think, can we safely say that God is love, but I think in absolutely reverse, we can say that love is God. To love is to be like God, when we understand what love truly is. Now, we can slap that word on a lot of different things, but that doesn't mean it's the same thing as what God is. And so really, I think when we talk about love, and when we ask ourselves, how do we love? How should we love? What does it mean to love God and love your neighbor as yourself? That calls on us to understand God. That calls on us in some level to know who God is, because you cannot understand love unless you understand in some capacity, in the limited capacity we can, who God is. And so you can't separate those two things. That, you know, that idea of God is love, it's an intrinsic statement. And so it's highly critical that we understand that. And again, that has ramifications for us as well. So what else do we mean? What do we mean when we say God is love? Yeah, and I like Zane's phraseology there, that God is the source of love. And so if God is the source of love, what does that mean about our love? What is our love? Yeah, it's a reflection, an example, a manifestation of God's love, that ultimately our love in a very deep way is a part of God's love. It is a reflection of God's love. It is us engaging in God's love. And so really I think it makes a lot of sense when Jesus says that the greatest of these commandments is love God. That ultimately that is the duty of man. That is the task of mankind, is as God has loved us, we love Him. And there's so much that goes into that concept of what it means to love God. But ultimately what it means is that our love is a reflection of His love. That when we love properly, when we love in the correct way, we are glorifying God. We are essentially demonstrating God. We are showcasing God. We are showing this is what it truly means to love, is because we love like God loves. And so yeah, I think that's a huge part of it, is that God is the source of love. And so when we engage properly in love, it is a reflection of that original love. What else does it mean? What else can we say about God is love? What does it mean about us? How does that define humanity? If God is love, what does that make us? As the image of God, perhaps? Yeah, that wasn't meant to be a trick question. We are examples of God's love. That ultimately creation, and not just humanity, but creation as a whole, is a manifestation of God's love. It is ultimately, and the apostles talk a lot about this in the New Testament, but so too do the psalmists, that creation is a manifestation of God's love, that creation is an outpouring of God's love. And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about the triune nature of God, that creation flows out of that love that God has within Himself. And so when we talk about God as love, this is also an important part of it, that God as Father, as Son, and as Spirit, it is a constant relationship of love. Ultimately, that is the definition of the triune God, of the Trinity of God, is the loving relationship between Father and Son, between the Spirit that comes from the Father and the Son. And so creation is out of that love. It is a manifestation of that love that God has within Himself. It is an overflowing of God's love. And so we as creation are part of God's love. And ultimately, what I think I can safely assert is that when we are in line with God's wisdom, when we are in line with God's vision, we are in line with God's love. We are becoming part of God's love. We are ascribing to God's love that, yes, this is the proper way. This is the right way. When we are in proper relationship with God and with others, we are entering into that triune nature of love. We are agreeing with creation. We talked about this in Proverbs, that that's the whole idea of God's wisdom, of Chokmah, that it's the natural order of creation. It is the law and the wisdom and the rule of creation. And so when we are properly fulfilling the role of the image of God, we are expressions of God's love. And so I think there's a lot that we could talk about with this concept of love, and really we could spend a whole quarter talking about this. But I think this has to be the lens through which we look at everything. And so we're going to talk in a couple of weeks about what the Bible says about the wrath of God. The wrath of God is viewed through the lens of the love of God. That those are not two separate or two opposing aspects of each other. The wrath of God is a part of the love of God. Now, that may mean we need to better understand what those two concepts mean, but all of God is through His love. His omnipotence, His omniscience, His omnipresence is part of the idea that God is love. His wisdom, His Spirit, His holiness, all of that is a part of God is love. And so again, this is, I think, the most fundamental thing that we can understand, the most fundamental thing that's been revealed about God, is that particularly given the triune nature, He is love, and everything that comes from God is defined through that. And so love is really going to serve as kind of the undergirding of all these things. We'll talk more about this, like I said, when we get into some of the questions of wrath and judgment, all those things, that those things are not separate from God's love. And so we'll talk more about that in a future class. But even holiness, again, as Trish kind of brought up, that is God's love. That God's love is not just that He in some ways kind of distanced us from holiness for now, but God's love is also that He is drawing us closer to His holiness and preparing us to be in His presence of holiness. Holiness without love it's just destruction. It's just, we would be consumed. We'd be burned up. And so it is God's love that shields us from holiness now, but also prepares us and builds us to be in the presence of that holiness. And so love, genuinely, just, it undergirds this entire discussion. Thoughts or comments on the nature of God's love? All right, I know we can talk a lot more about that. We'll talk next week, probably getting into Lesson 9. We'll touch very, very briefly on the two other aspects of God talked about in Lesson 8. But very good. Appreciate the discussion tonight. Good things.